Welcome to North Pod Law, Series 7, Episode 2, recorded on the 24th of January, 2013. Money. Welcome to North Pod Law. You've got Ben looking very confused because that is not the title of the show that we agreed. But I can't remember what the title is that we agreed. So
it was by good disputation, the law shall be well known was the title.
Excellent.
I prefer money.
Fair enough.
I couldn't remember it all.
I
don't know what's wrong with you. Fruits. Pensions man of a fruit fly, Bezic.
Had a baby.
Anywho,
can't
hello
remember
all.
Anything. Anyway, hello, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Marvellous. Right, this week it's not quite all about money, but there is quite a bit about money this week. It was starting with a ruling that has taken Ben's eye and quite a lot of other people about legal privilege, whether it extends to. Other professions, or shall I put it that way? Other professions.
We're moving my breaking news story to later in the show, evidently. I had breaking news.
Well, tell us what your breaking news story is.
All right, breaking news. So today, Richard Pratt of Queen's Counsel, who is the leader of the Northern Circuit, published a circular at the end of the business day today, so the 24th, saying that on Monday of this week, the 21st, he, with other circuit leaders, met with the Lord Chancellor Chris Grayling. I can't find a sound effect for the Stormtrooper march. Never mind. The meeting apparently had been arranged some time ago and was certainly not consequential upon the article that Grayling had written in the Sunday Times or the...
I think that's probably right. Program.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. Anyway, one of the purposes of dealing with it was to, as he put it, establish a dialogue so as to have proper representation of the bar with the minister, or Secretary of State, I should say. Oh, no, he's a minister, Lord Chancellor. Anyway, so the subjects that were on the table were these. I'm not going to delve too far into them, but just know that this is what's being discussed. This is taken from the circular. So financial changes, challenges rather, facing the Ministry of Justice. The need to look at options concerning the use of legal aid and levels of representation. Well, we're kind of going to refer to a bit of that in a little while on the case. The maintenance of the independent bar as a provider of high quality legal service. This is about QASA, which we've spoken about. Although at this point he feels it necessary to sort of interject and say, we did not and do not purport to negotiate formally on the behalf of the bar. That's because it wasn't the bar council or anyone else. It was the leaders of the circuit. They want to. These are their aims in this sort of negotiation. They want to maintain the reputation of the bar as a provider of high value quality work. They want to try and get rid of the one case one fee because they say that will inevitably drive down quality. Discuss. They want to bring back this whole issue of using frozen assets to fund defence fees, and so not taking it out of legal aid. You might think that's a very good idea.
You're quite fond of that one, aren't you?
Well, we've talked about it on the show before. Yeah. It seems to make abundant sense, especially with the changes in legal aid that have now come about. It seems perfectly logical.
In fact, that was suggested, wasn't it, right back when we started this podcast, when there was a meeting of the CBA down in Holborn, and that was one of the most sensible propositions that I think was put forward, and I've never heard a good argument against it.
I've even read the discussions in Hansard about it, and I've still not seen anything in there that convinces me to the contrary. But there you go. QASA, as I say, was on the table. In relation to that, the bar's position, or at least, sorry, I've made a mistake there. The Northern Circuit and other circuit leaders' position was that the scheme has been diluted too far with this whole plea-only advocate stuff. And the point they make, I quite like the way they sort of word that. Effectively, that provides a mechanism as well for those who wish to be assessed in simulated and non-real courtrooms. So, in other words, it's actually quite an artificial type of assessment. That's a fair argument, I think, but again, discuss. Then there's the issue of QCs in serious cases, which, as you know, has been in the headlines this week. I won't go back over that for now. These are all various things. They do consider the possibility in this circular that the government might well listen but ultimately ignore what is said. But as he says, that won't prevent us from saying it, at least. There you go. There's going to be a conference about this later, a circuit-wide video link meeting at some point, and we can all get involved, I'm sure, in that and cheer ourselves right up. We'll probably end up covering that on Northpod, I would imagine.
Mm. Does it not strike you as a very strange minutes of a meeting?
Well, yes, because the minutes simply say these are sort of headings.
It's more of an agenda.
I was going to say,
there's not a lot. I mean, did Chris Grayling just sit there silent throughout the whole of this and not say anything at all in reply?
Well, maybe.
It wasn't much of a meeting,
was it?
I'm
in such dangerous territory of feeling quite free to have a pop at the Lord Chancellor, but I shall skip it just for now. I'll save that for another show, so I'm not too ranty. But seriously, Christ's sake. Anyway, there you go.
Can I get on with telling them what we're doing in the rest of the show now?
Yeah. Yes, you absolutely must.
Thank you. You trust me to actually get through it?
Yes. Go on,
track on. I can't now because I've managed to lose my bit of paper with it on. That's clever. So first thing we're going to discuss after we've discussed the breaking news story, which I think we've just done, is this case on legal professional privilege, whether it extends to other professions. Then we've got a case which is regarding fines. It's actually more about default fines, but it is interesting because it has some knock-on effects in terms of what is a legitimate fine and a reminder of several things, actually. So it's more of a reminder case, but we'll get into that. Then we've got... What have we got after that? Bear with me one moment. Then we have got, she said, trying to find it. It's going well this week.
We are still in various locations and conducting this over Google Hangouts. So
yeah, also trying to use technology. Very bad, isn't it? We're normally quite good with this. Ben's got an interesting family case, actually, in regard to experts. You may have seen this on Crimeline, but this is... a case about biomechanic experts and whether they are of use at all, whether you could ever use them in a case legitimately, and how you go about whether you can have funding for them, but experts generally and the funding for them, specifically in family cases, but it's has some knock-on effects in other cases as well. And then Jonathan has an interesting case fresh from the Court of Appeal, which is DH Jamaica, and it's about rights of... Well, it's sort of about rights of children, isn't it, Jonathan?
Yeah, it ends up being about children because almost in every case that this involves, it's to do with children who've got EU rights and parents who aren't EU nationals, so don't automatically get those rights. And what happens when you start to mix that up? That's what the case is about.
Okay. So, Ben... When is professional when is legal privilege not legal privilege?
Well, Kirsten, you can only be talking about the Queen on the application of Prudential PLC and another against the Special Commissioner of Income Tax and another. There are interveners, a go-go, Law Society, Bar Council, Institute of Chartered Accountants, whoever, AIPPI, I think that's another accountancy body, and the Legal Services Board, all chipping in and leaving it to dear Lord Neuberger, with whom Lord Walker agrees to give a judgment. All right, very briefly, what's it about? One question, very simple for the Supreme Court. Well, not very simple, but one question. Following receipt of a statutory notice from an inspector of taxes to produce documents in connection with its tax affairs, is a company entitled to refuse to comply on the grounds that the documents were covered by legal advice privilege? Legal advice privilege is a sort of category that includes what you probably more familiar with, which is legal professional privilege. This is a case where legal advice was given by accountants in relation to tax avoidance schemes. Ooh, topical. Right, so...
that legal advice is, in effect, accountancy advice, isn't it? I mean, it's obviously is about the law because the tax system is a legal entity and it's how to deal with it and the best way of presenting your tax affairs.
Spot on.
And that's... one of the points of the judgment, isn't it, is to realistically whether is that legal advice, in effect.
Yeah, so by way of background, legal professional privilege has always really been understood to apply to qualified lawyers, so solicitors and barristers. In fact, I'm not even sure whether, strictly speaking, it applies to ILEX, save where it is within the privilege that applies to the client and the firm of solicitors.
I think because any advice that you're given by ILEX presumably would be covered on behalf of your principals.
Yeah, one would imagine.
Professional privilege.
Yeah. So the question comes really very simple. Given that accountants and various others are engaged to give advice on their area of expertise, whether the parts of that that are effectively advice on where their client stands in relation to the law, whether those parts are covered by legal professional privilege. Now, all right, so arguments on both sides. The argument of the firm and the accountants against the idea that that only applies to lawyers can really be summarized as being that the people who are giving that specialist legal advice are doing so within the sphere of their abilities. It requires a degree of candor from those who are instructing them, which is no different than if it were a lawyer giving that advice. And really, the situations are immediately comparable. The argument against it is effectively that it would create uncertainty if the LPP, the legal professional privilege, were to be extended to other providers of legal, with inverted commas, advice. Now, actually, although with the accountant situation there, you may think, well, what is the difference? Just think about some of the other consequences. So let's imagine that, well, let's pick an example. I probably should have thought of one off air, but let's imagine that a business has a specialist consultant come in to look at their risk in terms of tripping and slipping or drowning or something or whatever, some sort of business in the leisure industry. That person is probably qualified in terms of their health and safety qualifications and whatever else that gives them that job, and they're working under a company that provides that advice as a consultancy. Now,
well, there could be anything, couldn't you? You've got the health and safety issues.
Yeah.
Generally, you've also got data protection.
Yeah,
and if someone could come in and advise you on data protection, does that mean you're never going to be able to hand over anything? Because
no, absolutely,
it's just gives an awful lot of uncertainty, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and so the argument here really was that Parliament created legal professional privilege for one specific group of people, and the argument as to why is that the relationship between solicitor, barrister, and lay client is unusual, because if you're requiring the services of those people, there is an issue, or maybe an issue, somewhere within your personal business life that may ultimately leave you open to liability, whether it's criminal or civil or whatever else. You've gone to them so you can be completely honest and say, right, look, this is the situation we're in, here's what we want to do, or what we've done, or what we want to achieve. With these pieces of information, without us disclosing things that might otherwise incriminate us, how do we proceed? And the idea is that the lawyers are able, on the basis of that advice, to be very full and frank. It doesn't, and welcome to the world of criminal clients sometimes, it doesn't mean that the lawyer is free to say, right, well, you've told me all of that, and now I'm going to tell you what you ought to be saying instead. Sorry, potential criminal defendants.
Anybody really, that isn't what we do.
No, absolutely. The number of times a lawyer will get asked in their career, well, what do you think I should say? And the answer is, you give your evidence. Simple as that. Or if you're in a police station, you say nothing. But, you know. So lots of people sort of weighed in. Like, the Law Society were very keen to guard the position. And the question might be why. And this is really what gave rise to the concerns of the Institute for Chartered Accountants.
I mean, there are so many issues in this, aren't there? I mean, one of the things we were just talking about there is the reason why you go to see a barrister or a solicitor. And the key is that you go to see them because of – you go with a view to litigation. an involvement in the law. You go because you want to avoid it, or but it's with a view to there may be litigation in this case, and what do I need to do about that? When you go and see your accountant, you're not supposed to be going with a view to what with somebody coming and investigating your affairs. You're supposed to go with a view to saying how much tax ought I be paying. And that's a very different thing, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And the question then raised by the Institute of Chartered Accountants is whether, if it only extends to lawyers, kind of ignoring the rationale that you sensibly bring up, Kirsten, if it only applies to lawyers, they're now suggesting that this is anti-competitive. Now, again, think about what's being said here, though, because the justification now is that there are now multidisciplinary practices. So this is, for those who don't know, this is offices of lawyers with accountants, with other providers of professional services. And the argument is, within those companies, that there may be a question as to what part of the company is given advice and whether it's been mixed in together and whether that has privilege attached to it. It is true to say that Parliament are probably, in the light of multidisciplinary practices, going to have to look at this because it isn't as clear as perhaps it was. But for now, at least, the Supreme Court has said, no, if this needs changing, it's not a matter for the court, it is a matter for Parliament, and until they do otherwise, there is no LPP attaching to these documents, so cough them up was the basic answer, which I'm sure will please the Treasury, because I imagine they're rather busy looking at such things at the moment.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, isn't it, I think, to see what Parliament make of it, whether because the legal professional privilege is there for so many reasons. Due to the fact that we have a duty to the court, we have that duty not to mislead under any circumstances. We have a professional body behind us, which I have to say, I concede, so do professional accountants.
Yes.
But what bothers me is the people who've been talking about this, the argument was that it should be accountants and other professionals. And it was, well, what do you mean by other professionals? Because actually what you mean are people who are not professionals at all. You mean people who are employed by accountants firms who are not professionals and shouldn't be giving advice.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, there is something of a floodgates argument here. And also, as a lot of people have commented who've discussed it online, it sort of flies in the face slightly, and perhaps welcomely from the lawyer's point of view, of this sort of devaluing of the legal profession, because the Supreme Court is still clearly, by this judgment, recognising that lawyers have a clear, distinct professional function that is not exercised by whether it's accountants or whether it's other people. It's a very distinct function. That's something which we'll pick up on again later in the show on the child case.
Well, it's going to be interesting, is it? It's going to be interesting again to see what Parliament's view of that is, given that our general feeling that Parliament don't have any time at all for lawyers and don't recognise that we provide a sensible service at all.
Yeah,
it's absolutely going to be interesting to see what Parliament say. A bit worrying, actually, as well.
Probably, fingers crossed. Anyway, what's
next?
Yep.
Next, then, is Pennell and South Western Magistrates Court. This is a judicial review matter in regard to fines. In fact, the actual outcome of the case was that the judicial review itself, in effect, was successful because the fine that he was ultimately made to pay, this gentleman, it's a default a matter where he was in default of fines, but the amount that they ordered him to pay was sort of £950 in £5 instalments per week, and they threw that out on the basis that the time limit for paying that, or what is recognised as a time limit for sensible payment of any fine, he couldn't do that within the time. So in fact, the payment period necessary to discharge that debt was too great. And therefore his judicial review was successful. What's interesting in the case is that although it's not the reasons given by the magistrates at the time, as far as I can tell, the reasons given to the High Court by the magistrates for imposing it was that he had said in court that he wasn't going to pay anything anyway. So it appears that they've basically said, well, he's not going to pay anything. We might as well shove anything in front of him. They don't seem to have...
Stuff him.
Seem to have sort of stopped in their duty at that point. And the High Court said, no, once you've ascertained that £5 a week is all that he can afford, you have to then look at the fine, the, you know, the totality of the fine, and make certain that that is the amount that he can pay within the specified time period.
That's quite a sensible approach. One might think common sense.
Well, it's not just common sense. It's actually the one that the statute expects and requires as well.
Oh, it is. But I can understand the magistrate's position as well. I mean, this guy's defaulted and defaulted, and you know, and these sort of he looks like he's not paying. He's objecting to things. He's appealing this left, right, and centre. He's got fines in goodness knows how many courts. And I can understand why they, in effect, they just sort of said, well, he's not going to pay anything. It's just. You know, let's see what happens when he's defaulted on this then.
I mean, the correct procedure, for those who don't know, perhaps not criminal practitioners or whatever, is actually relatively straightforward. Once the fines have been identified, which, of course, there will have been a means assessment at the time they're imposed, or there should have been, if there is then a default, person is usually brought on warrant in most cases, let's be frank.
Oh, he was?
He was, yeah. To court, where enforcement hearing takes place. Now, an enforcement hearing necessarily involves a means inquiry, and it has to be a thorough one, because one of the options that is open to the enforcing court is imposing a custodial sentence. Should be straightforward, isn't, because a lot of magistrates' courts seem to jump the gun and go from a means inquiry into custody. Now, it's important to recognise in this that basically, the real justification, the only time you can sort of skip to the end, if you like, for a magistrate's court in considering custody, is if the person has shown willful refusal or culpable neglect in paying the fine. Now, that isn't that is a very high standard to reach. And, of course, the problem is here, the magistrates have put the cart right before the horses. They put the cart right back at the start, which is, well, we could just deal with this fine, but realistically, you already say you're not going to pay it, so we'll hit you with as much as we sensibly, well, not sensibly, can. We won't care about how you can pay it or when you can pay it over, because you're not going to, and then we can send you to prison. No, says the court.
No. What I can't work out from the case, actually, is how they came to this £950, but it doesn't really matter. One of the things, the reason the case is that is interesting, and I have to concede it's particularly interesting as a northerner, because it puts that there, London, in not the rosiest of lights, it has to be said. Bless them, their technology, it doesn't really work very well down there in the big smoke.
Well, yeah, and actually, this could potentially cost this defendant a little bit, because in this Fines case, one of the problems was that the defendant had not told the court about fines that existed from another court.
I don't know. He does, but he doesn't necessarily know the exact amount. So he hasn't told them the right amount. He may not have told them about all of them.
Yeah, I think that's the problem.
To give him a bit of due, this is the claimant in this case, Beaumont's Judicial Review, so the defendant. He had 20 convictions over the last 12 years, mainly driving offences, and they totaled £4,170.65. So you can perhaps understand how he managed to miss a few along the way.
Yeah.
He's managed to commit offences, or at least be dealt with them, in all four areas of London. That is the South East, the South West, the North East, and the North West.
Wow.
And each of those areas has a separate database, and they don't talk to each other, really.
Oh, dear.
In
what
particular...
What magistrate's court was judicially reviewed?
Yes, this is a judicial review.
No, sorry, which magistrate court was it?
Western. South Western.
South West, as in... Right, okay, yep.
Is it former stomping ground, Jonathan?
I'm just checking now.
What is interesting, and this one I'm sure is, this place will be former stomping ground, I'm sure, Jonathan, is that one of the convictions, quite a big one in this case, the conviction was in the northeast, the northeastern area of London, but he appealed it, and the appeal was heard at Snaresbrook. I can't believe you've not been to Snaresbrook in all your time.
No, I have been to Snaresbrook, and I've just checked. I've been to Southwestern Mags as well.
So, now, Snaresbrook, the finds there, they're recorded on the Southwestern database.
Bravo.
So when the court came to deal with this, they have £2,760 outstanding, but they didn't really know that a large chunk of that should have been suspended pending appeal. Some of it had been quashed. I don't want to get into the actual case really, but because his appeal had been successful, the fine would have been suspended. There was going to be a rehearing, and the costs would be quashed entirely.
Right.
So, in fact, he only owed to the Southwestern database, he only owed £715, not £2,760, which you might think makes quite a big difference.
It's fascinating as well. I mean, there's a few little peculiar strands to this case. On the subject of costs, on the one hand, the court say, well, you know, you declared some of it, and it seems possibly not all of it. They then say, you know, they go on at length about imposing something at £5 a week, which would take an insane amount of time, is disproportionate, and so on. But then at the end, they're obliged to point out that Section 85 of the Magistrates' Courts Act does allow for remitting of fines, but it doesn't allow for the remitting of compensation and costs. Now,
I think that is quite an interesting point in it, though, because it's something that we tend to forget. Yes, you can't remit compensation and costs, but you can discharge them or reduce them. You have to, if that is being considered, victims are supposed to be consulted, and they should be given an opportunity to attend at court.
Absolutely, yeah.
And equally with, presumably with the CPS and such, like anybody who's claiming costs, should be able to come and make representation to the court should they wish to. But there does tend to be, I think if you do appeals at the Crown Court, there does tend to be just sort of get ridden over if it's a sentencing hearing. Well, there's nothing I can really do about compensation.
Yeah.
Once compensation is awarded, well, but actually that's not true. And no, we do tend to forget that, actually. I think it's a timely reminder.
The nice little sting in the tail of this judgment, there's two of them really. One is on that point, is that, so they're talking about the affordability. They contemplate the possibility that the amount outstanding may be £2,600 and whatever pounds, and the claimants' means are what they are, and the court will therefore have to consider other ways of enforcement or remitting. They then go on to consider the point about cost, but in the final paragraph of the judgment, beautiful, so just bear in mind, we're concerned about affordability over time, so on and so forth. They say, we wish finally to make it clear that although Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunal Service was at fault in its system not having taken account of the claimant's success on his judicial review in having the judgment of the Crown Court at Snaresbrook quashed, the claimant was at fault in not disclosing the other outstanding fines. That will be relevant to any issue of costs. Are you going to do? Impose them on him and then have those not enforceable as well? Brilliant.
Yeah.
Anyway, and the other thing is, there's a nice little dig in there at the fact that justices' clerks, perhaps there's not enough of them, and perhaps their equipment's been too hampered by austerity measures. There's going to be some very angry justice clerks because they're carefully reminded that it is their duty at these hearings to make sure they've undertaken a thorough inquiry into outstanding fines and everything else. Sorry, guys, you're going to be a lot busier, it seems.
What is interesting on that point, two things as well. The court service intend to contract out the collection of fines, and it is noted in the judgment that hopefully that should bring with it a national database. So that's going to have some effects as well on people all over the country, not just in London. Presumably, that's going to be the case here. You know, there should be legal advisors all over the country should be able to tap into the national database and make certain that those issues are correct.
Which would make sense, wouldn't it, let's be honest.
You'd hope so, wouldn't you? And the other thing in terms of the legal advisers is that there is also a reminder. I'm going to read this bit out, I think, because I seem to remember it's quite good, but it also goes into the Consolidated Criminal Practice And they were reminded that they are to put questions, but that it is not an adversarial process. So when you're asking the defendant about the defaulter about this, yes, they're supposed to ask questions, but it's not adversarial, and legal advisors are not to stray into the role of the prosecutor. Well, that's going to come as news, I think, to quite a lot of justices clerks.
That could be very interesting indeed.
Can extend that as well to the trial process?
I thought that, yes, certainly in terms of driving matters.
Oh, don't.
Well, the Consolidated Criminal Practice Directions at V5510 says the role of the legal advisors in fine default proceedings or other proceedings for the enforcement of financial orders, order, obligation or penalties is to assist the court. They must not act in any adversarial or partisan manner. With the agreement of the justices, a legal advisor may ask questions of the defaulter to elicit information which the justices will require to make an adjudication.
Yes.
For example, to facilitate his explanation for the default. A legal advisor may also advise the justices in the normal way as to the options open to them in dealing with the case. The duty of impartiality is the... bear in mind, this is basically the court against the defaulter. It's going to come as news to quite a lot of legal advisors. They're supposed to be impartial. They're not supposed to be on the side of the court. The duty of impartiality is the paramount consideration for the legal advisor at all times, and this takes precedence over any role he may have as a collecting officer. I think that would come as news to a lot of legal advisors.
Probably would, except for the fact that the safeguard against that, for them, I suppose, is the fact that in most of the fines cases like that, first of all, people will be unrepresented, and secondly, if they do have representation, they'll have a duty solicitor who, to be frank, given that there's no representation order coming out of that ultimately, yep, it will be the bottom of their list.
Yep.
So unless there's unless a solicitor sat in the back of the court thinking, hang on a minute, this isn't on, it's perhaps a little unlikely that anything will get picked up on that.
No, that's the problem, isn't it? But something should be done about that.
Quite right. Something should be done.
Something should be done, frankly, yes.
And talking about things that should be done, just before we move on to the next item, it's about time to remind you how you contact the show. Do you like my segue? I thought it was quite good.
That was beautiful. Very
good. I thought so. You can contact the show by telephone, leave us a voicemail. That number is 0161 408 5037. You can find us on Twitter. Where are we, Bezic?
We're at NorthPod Law.
We are indeed. You can also contact the show by email, which is, Jonathan?
mail@northpod.co.uk.
Very good. You will have noticed, dear listeners, well, you may not have done, depending on how you listen to us, that we've moved. We have. We're no longer with Podomatic.
Well, I'm hoping that they've noticed, otherwise they're not going to be able to hear this, are they?
Well, I know people using iTunes will know, because I asked Apple to move it, and rather unusually they cooperated and did do. If you're listening to this on a website because you can't get it on your other device, whatever it may be, then if you go to www.northpodlaw.co.uk, you'll now see from there that you can, there's a line of, there's an address, a URL, that you can cut and paste into your phone or whatever it may be, and then you'll start picking this up as usual.
So who's hosting us now?
We are.
Oh, excellent.
Yes. Oh, yes, we've moved on. We're moving up in the world, you know.
Sounds good.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What's up next, Bezic?
You are, matey. We're covering your family case.
Oh, family case.
When can you have an expert? Can you have an expert?
No,
you can have experts?
Yes, apparently so. All right, so this is... this is a case, effectively, as Kirsten said in the intro, about a type of evidence you may not have heard of before. This is a non-accidental injury case. That is to say that this is injuries to a child as in an infant, I should say, as well, whereby the parents are sometimes prosecuted, and there was certainly in relation to the mother in this case a parallel prosecution running in the background, but also there's obviously family proceedings in terms of local authorities. Now, the question in this case, which was before the Court of Appeal, was effectively, which experts are required and what's the balancing act? In short, the father, in this case, wanted to put forward into evidence the report of an expert in biomechanical injuries. Taking the stuff aside, all that means, in reality, is the effect of the physics of different mechanisms causing an injury on the body. The reason it's perhaps interesting for family practitioners and criminal practitioners is that it goes into a lot of the history of non-accidental injury expert cases.
Are we talking about baby shaking?
Baby shaking, one example.
Potentially more in this case. Yeah. This case, Jonathan, is this is a child that had rib injuries, fractures of the ribs, and also head injuries, although... And the experts were sort of saying, well, it's happened over a couple of, you know, over more than one day.
Yeah. Right.
More than one incident. The only explanation for any of the injuries that the parents could come up with was an incident where the child had been placed in a baby-type seat, one of the sort of ones that's sort of a V-frame of metal with a cloth over the top of it, which the baby then sits in, a bit like a baby bouncer.
Yeah.
It had been placed in the kitchen. And there'd been a sort of, the child had been left alone in this, there'd been a crash, and the when the parents walked in, the 13-month-old sibling was sitting with his back to the door, with his feet up on top of the baby, and the baby was sort of face down on the floor.
Right.
Or head up on the floor, I'm not quite sure which actually, but the feet of the child were on top of the baby. Putting aside, nobody seems to have mentioned anywhere, putting aside the issue of leaving an 11-day-old baby alone on a kitchen floor with a toddler, a 13-month-old toddler running around. The issue here, there was a finding of fact due as to whether, as to how those injuries had occurred.
Right.
And this is the only thing that the parents have put forward. The interesting point from the case here is that nobody had seen the incident, and much was made of that by the local authority. You know, nobody even saw this accident, so how can you possibly have somebody, an expert, look at the mechanics of it see if it could have accounted for those injuries? You know, nobody saw it.
The only way, surely, if you're saying no one saw it, nobody has any evidence of seeing it, surely reconstruction by means of an expert analysis is only way.
Well, hang on. Let's back up a little bit.
You might think that they didn't.
Let's see.
All right. So this is a decision on appeal of an interim decision by the judge dealing with the case. So the judge dealing with the case had been asked by the father repeatedly, in fact, and with some support from a doctor. We don't actually know who he is. We know his name, but we don't really know what.
I think the doctor actually comes in later. Originally there wasn't any support from the doctor. There wasn't any support from anybody other than mother, who was supporting it, and guardian was sort of neutral. After the first decision was made, it appears that letter from the doctor comes forward with quite a bit of support, I would say.
Well, this is a doctor who we don't know what his role in it is. He isn't the biomechanical expert.
Assuming we're both talking about the same doctor, he's the radio neurologist.
Ah, right. Okay. Well spotted.
So he's one of the experts that they're actually relying on in the case.
One of five, to be clear, as well.
Yeah, but he says very clearly that he couldn't actually really comment on how those injuries. He's the neuro guy, so he's the guy who's going to talk about how the head injuries occur, which again you might think is quite significant.
Now, he says in his letter to the court, I strongly support the notion that an expert biomechanics report be obtained. Now, the judge dealing with this case at first instance refuses the father permission to rely on this expert. For those who don't know, the permission to rely on expert evidence is something that must be sought from the court, Rule 25.41 of the Civil Procedure Rules. Family Procedure Rules in that case. Now, the decision here was, well, no, I don't think it's necessary. The judge basically summed it up into a couple of different categories as to why. One, what would he be reconstructing? All we've got is a possible explanation for one injury. There are other potential injuries as well. There's just nothing there that would help us. We already know that an injury without an explanation doesn't necessarily make it a non-accidental injury. Where does this take us beyond what the normal experts say?
Sure.
He was criticised in this application by counsel for the father for effectively denying him, amongst other things, Article 6 rights, that's the right to a fair trial, on that point, the court said, well, all right, yes, Article 6 is engaged. You have a right to a fair trial, but nothing in European law whatsoever, including Strasbourg authorities or whatever else, requires that all evidence must be put before the court. There's no entitled to litigate on whatever you want. The convention requires that if there's going to be an investigation into what took place, there needs to be a full merits investigation, which needs to be fair, taken as a whole. And the court here said, well, we're quite satisfied that the judge was looking at the whole of this. He knew what the situation was. He knew what the father's contentions were. He knew roughly what the mother's contentions were, which were broadly the same on this particular point, at least. He had five medical experts who could give evidence as to the things they did know. What purpose would it serve to have an expert give evidence of things that they didn't know? I paraphrase massively. Obviously, read the judgment. It's actually a very interesting judgment anyway. Go and read the judgment if you want to. The argument against it then, this was for the local authority, again, was pretty much cut up into those parts. So what does this judgment actually tell us? Why is it useful? Well, first of all, it tells us that there's not this absolute right. But secondly, it tells us a little bit more about the court's attitude under the rules as they currently stand, and, interestingly enough, the rules as they are about to become. The law is fairly imminently going to change, in so much as the family procedure rules at the moment say that expert evidence will be restricted to that which is reasonably required to resolve the proceedings. That is, as of the 31st of January of this year, so a couple of weeks away, going to change. It will then say, under the new version, expert evidence will be restricted to that which, in the opinion of the court, is necessary to assist the court in resolving the proceedings. So necessary, as opposed to reasonably required. So, in other words, if there was ever any doubt as to whose hands this lies in, the decision-making power lies in, it is the judge. There is no absolute right. What's perhaps a broader interest in this case is the observations made by the judge regarding the way in which the appeal is brought. I won't bore you with the details of I do enjoy in the judgment the judge going through what the questions might be in terms of Newtonian mechanics. Go back and enjoy that at your leisure, as I'm sure you will. The judge here says, well, look, a little word about how this is brought. We have before us in these proceedings, frankly, too many counsel. He put it slightly more politely than that, but basically, I'll tell you how many counsel he had. He had counsel for the father, counsel for the mother, counsel for the local authority, and counsel for the children's guardian. Understandably, perhaps, he was a bit miffed at that and decided that he would have a pop at it. What he said was this. Again, I'm going to paraphrase. The fact that mother, deal with mother first, she adds nothing to this argument. She doesn't necessarily accept what father says, but she doesn't contest it, and she doesn't support it for any reasons other than those that the father supports it. Local authority contests it. Fine, they should be there. Nobody else needs to be there. If, as was ordered in this case, actually, a skeleton argument would do. The judge in this case, I'm trying to find the relative paragraph now, I can't put my hands on it, but the judge in giving directions in this case for the appeal said the court will be much assisted by submissions from the children's guardian, but does not require the guardian to be present or represented if the guardian takes the view that the filing of skeleton argument will suffice.
Presumably the guardian took the view that it wouldn't suffice.
Well, you would think so, although actually,
what's the point of giving the guardian the discretion and then saying you're taking it away from them when they exercise
it? Absolutely, because it's bizarre, isn't it? Because they're quite prepared to say, well, you're not having an expert because it's disproportionate or unnecessary, but they're not prepared to provide an absolute ruling, you're not being represented or attending because that's not necessary.
I find it, I know you said you think it's understandable that they're querying this number of counsel, and I can see why you say that. The point in this case, though, was that you've got a father who obviously needs to be there Father's council needs to be there, and the local authority, because the argument is between the two of them, ostensibly. But the guardian represents the children, and it's all about the children. So the effect of this judgment is going to have the biggest effect on the children than anybody else. So you can understand, I think, why the guardian would have liked somebody, their own council, to be there.
Well absolutely.
To make submissions, potentially, if they felt it was necessary. I mean, what if the local authority had capitulated and they hadn't thought that was right? When they got to the Court of Appeal.
Paragraph 72 of the judgment is quite an eloquently phrased support for skilled and determined counsel, to quote the judgment. Again, may there never be wanting an adequate supply of skilled and determined lawyers, barristers and solicitors willing and able to undertake this vitally important work. And the whole rationale for that paragraph is that all judges sitting in this type of work over any period of experience will have seen, as he puts it, seemingly solid care cases brought by local authorities being demolished, crumbling away at the hands of skilled and determined counsel. So I think really what they're saying is, look, apply the test yourselves. If you have nothing to add to this particular appeal, then you know, stick it on paper that you don't, and don't turn up.
I suppose so. But the point being that obviously the Guardian, I mean, the thing is the Guardian presumably felt that may change in the course of the proceedings. They may wish to make representations. In the case of Mother, wasn't she awaiting criminal charges in this matter as well?
Absolutely.
And the decision as to whether she should be charged. You can understand why she might want somebody.
Well, except for the fact that there's no finding of fact, is there, in the appeal case? So
no, but it affects how likely it is that she gets the piece of evidence that she's going to need, because obviously if the finding of fact goes well for them, she's not going to be facing criminal charges. So it's her application too, really. Although it's only the father making the application on paper, it's actually her application as well, and they're finding
that's
it on the basis that. One of the things that they're finding, the one of the reasons for not allowing the biomechanical expert is that Mother and Father allegedly have got different accounts as to how this accident has happened. In fact, they haven't. They've both got different suppositions as to how it occurred, although it's referred to all the time as different versions, and they contradict each other. I don't think they do contradict. Certainly from what I've read, they don't appear to contradict each other, because nobody seems to know how it's happened.
Well, nevertheless, the judge has given his words here, saying experience since I made the direction about people not turning up has fallen on deaf ears. In fact, since May 2010, where it was commented in some other case, I'm afraid it's not terribly important what case that was, this advice has fallen on deaf ears. The profession must take heed. This must stop. And there's a bit of a sting in that as well. So too, if I may say so, says the judge, should the relevant professional bodies. I don't think any professional body, with the greatest respect to the learned judge, is going to take issue with instructed solicitors or counsel attending at a hearing where their lay client, or professional client in some cases, believes that they ought to attend.
Yes.
I agree in terms of...
You've been instructed.
Yeah, I agree with his point about public funding. He says, you know, for every £100 of public money spent paying for separate representation of litigants in family cases who do not require it, 100% of that £100 is unavailable to pay for representation which is required. Well, there's a road you don't want to go down to.
Do you
at
think
the moment.
Now this, we've put this in the category of money this week? Yeah. Do we think money had quite a big role to play in this judgment, Mr. Knight?
I know our listeners are expecting me to say yes, so I shall say no controversially.
Well, do you not think the fact that it was £22,000 for the biomechanical expert's report, and he hasn't even attended court for that, from what I can gather?
No.
Sorry, $22,000. I do wonder, actually, whether somebody hadn't done the calculations. It comes down to about £14,000. But it's still quite a lot of money.
Well, it is. But I do agree with the sort of basic assertion that unless an expert can add something to a case, then there's no point in having their evidence admitted. There is a question, however, here as to whether the expert would have been able to be funded to undertake the investigation, research, and produce preliminary findings that might have assisted the court in deciding whether to allow the full application. Now, the problem you've got there is the fact that unless a court has said, yes, this is required, you will never get funding from the Legal Services Commission to pay for that. So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation. Mm. But yeah, money is a consideration, but let's not pretend the justice system doesn't always factor proportionality and money into cases.
Well, they cover it in the judgment.
They cover it in the judgment here,
don't they? They actually talk about it in the judgment here.
Yeah.
One of the things that it's one of the reasons he refused the application was because it has to be proportionate as far as the funding, the fee for the expert's report has to be proportionate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he didn't feel it was.
No, he didn't.
So it may be that had it been rather cheaper to get this bike, and it doesn't help that he's in America.
Yes, the other thing I should say about this for those who are considering instructing biomechanical experts in criminal cases or other family cases is that, yes, there are some authorities where the higher courts have said, yes, this information is useful. As the judge pointed out in this appeal, there are no family cases in which it's been of significant use because the criticism of it, same in crime cases, the criticism of this type of evidence is always that it is a growing area of science. There is reference made repeatedly to some guidance given by Dame Butler Sloss, in which she says, well, you know, today's growing area of science is tomorrow's pretty much, you know, unassailable facts.
Yes.
Well, I paraphrase massively, but yeah, there is an element of that, but that's been said for about 6 years now by the higher courts looking at the authorities. It probably hasn't changed much. And I think the real key piece of this information, if you're considering using this type of expert, is I think you've got to have a pretty darn good idea of the incident which is said to have caused the injury. Simply a mystery injury with only supposition as to what might have happened, you're almost never going to be able to justify using
that. No, it's very difficult, though, isn't it? Because one of the cases that's referred to in this judgment is Re-M, which incidentally was, coincidentally was, the judgment for that was given on the day that the appeal for this one was heard. So when the appeal was heard, the judgment in Re-M had not been made public, but in fact now has. And that is a recent case where it categorically states that just because an injury is unaccountable for, if you can't work out how this injury has occurred, that doesn't mean it was a non-accidental injury.
That's right.
Just because there is no explanation and it beggars belief. The difficulty, I think, is that it's so tempting in family cases for judges. It's a big thing to say, well, I can't account for this. No, there is no rational explanation for how this injury has occurred. So I'm going to give the child back to the parents, even though the injury is so horrendous. And in Re-M, they were particularly bad. Now, they got round it, I think, in that case, if it's not that one, it's another, by basically, I think it is Re-M. They found that, but they also didn't allow the appeal because the judge in that case had said that the parents were so unbelievable.
Yeah.
But in fact, she doesn't. She says that she just, there was nothing to make her believe the parents, which is actually slightly different. So you do wonder, really, is the onus in the family court, is it absolutely on you to say you have not caused this injury? And I think the outcome of that is probably yes.
Actually, I think there's probably a wider concern to that as well, because in criminal cases of non-accidental injury, so this is child neglect cases, when one reads through the authorities, looks at expert journals and so on, unfortunately, perhaps, it does seem, although there is no reverse burden of proof per se in these cases, when you read through them, the presumption is almost always, at least in the rhetoric, that the parent is at fault.
Yes.
And whether that's because, I mean, even this judgment, it includes the supposition of something that all parents of children will know, or mothers of children, in fact, in a rather sexist way, it says, will know. And as it happens, yes, it is a fairly obvious statement in this case, but it isn't always.
No.
And that's something people have got to watch out for. I should just mention very briefly as we finish that one up, Sir Mark Headley, this was, I think, his final judgment in the Court of Appeal, if I'm not mistaken. As such, he was given an opportunity to do a little bit of waxing lyrical towards the end of the judgment on the subject of family proceedings. He effectively is calling for continuity of judges in in family cases, especially this type of family cases, because of the importance that their role has, and the fact that the Court of Appeal cannot and will not, as was said in this case again, interfere with case management interlocutory decisions unless they are plainly wrong, to paraphrase. So he points out the necessity there. Of course, those who listen to the show regularly will know it's in April of this year in contact cases, private contact cases. Effectively, there's going to be a lot of self-representing people. Of course, the inquisitive role of the, in those cases, usually district judges, will become so much more important, and continuity of judge is going to become, I would say, essential in those cases at that stage. So he waxes lyrical about that. He then, in a beautiful bit of judicial U-turning, agrees entirely with what's said about this basic Newtonian mechanics that anybody can give evidence on, and says in the appendix to the judgment, here's a plan for further analysis, and then sets out a load of complicated, well, not complicated, questions of Newtonian physics for people to figure out and calculate so as to assist the court. It's the sort of thing you think you might want an expert on.
Oh! Jonathan, you've got about 5 minutes to tell us about DH Jamaica.
Okay, here we go. So the question is, how far does Zambrano extend? I know we've talked about Zambrano before, but it's still, I'll concede this straight away, I think it's difficult to understand. I think that the courts find it difficult to understand. But we've got a new case, and this is the case of DH Jamaica. And the question in this is, how far does it go? Does it go further than we've all thought already? So to give you a bit of a summary about what Zambrano is, Zambrano deals with who has the benefit of the rights of citizens of the Union? Do they stop at the citizens, or do they extend to family members of the citizens? And the case of Zambrano effectively says that you can have certain situations where non-citizens, non-EC citizens, will benefit from the rights of citizens if they are related to them. So a good example of this is the Zambrano case itself. So to give you a bit of a summary of what that was, the Zambrano case dealt with a situation whereby, as a result of a failure to extend citizen rights to non-EU citizens, the non-EU citizen would leave the EU, and therefore, because they've got their child with them, an EU citizen would also be compelled to leave. So this has always generally been extended to children. Zambrano dealt with children, and unsurprisingly, this case deals with children as well. So what the case of Zambrano decided was, amongst other things, effectively this. If you are forcing a citizen to leave the EU because you're also forcing one of their parents to leave, it doesn't matter that the parent isn't a citizen. You can't interfere with the rights of the EU citizen in that way, even if that means that the parent gets derivative rights from the child that have never been conferred by any form of treaty or internal statute or anything like that. Now, what the case of D.H. Jamaica, and just to give the full title of it, it's D.H., which is Damien Harrison, who didn't benefit from an anonymity direction. And it's also a second appellant, A.B. And both of those appeals are brought on effectively very similar bases. And those are, does it matter if the citizen is not actually being forced to leave the EU or one of its member states? Could the Zambrano principle extend to a situation where the child, let's say the child, because it's easier for me to remember than citizen, where the child doesn't have to leave, but where the quality of their life in that member state might be so adversely affected that you might be able to say that really you've impinged upon their right to reside in the European Union? Now, does anybody want to have a guess at what the outcome was?
I'm thinking how heavily driven things are by policy these days in this area, and thinking that the answer was probably a no.
Well, it was a no. And there's some very, very compelling submissions made It was a Mr. Drabble QC leading for both appellants, and then junior to Mr. Drabble QC for the appellant DH was Mikkel Karnick of our own Central Chambers.
I was about to say, it sounds terribly familiar, this fellow.
And then a Mr. Ranjiv Kubba was the junior in the case of AB. But effectively, the points made by Mr. Drabble were numerous, but included submissions that effectively, that there is language that comes from the Zambrano case and cases since then, which seems to be indicating that there is scope for movement in this direction. And effectively, that one can only make sense of the Zambrano principle if the whole point of enjoying your right of residence is to enjoy it in its full form, and that if it falls short of a full enjoyment of that right, then that constitutes a deprivation.
Well, you do wonder about right to family life, where that fits in, particularly if it were a child.
Yeah, well, the thing is, this is one of the aspects of this case, is that you have to deal with these two elements separately. You've got your Article 8 rights, but this case did raise those rights as well, on paper. In practice, this case, well, Mr. Drabble did not raise orally any of the arguments in relation to Article 8. It would appear, because they would appear to not be particularly strong. And I'd invite any readers to actually just read the judgment if you want to go through that, because effectively, in the case of DH, it was the case of he's really not been in the UK long enough.
Did he have a cat, Jonathan? I know Theresa May would like to know.
I'm sure the word cat's in there, Ben. I'm sure the word cat's in there somewhere.
I had to get Theresa May into the show somehow this week.
So the situation appears to be that it was conceded by the Court of Appeal that the EU law might develop in the direction, and as a general principle, conduct which materially impedes the exercise of an EU right is generally forbidden by EU law, in precisely the same way as a full deprivation of the right. But the conclusion was that it's necessary in this case to focus on what the nature of the right in issue was, and it's a right of residence. It's a right to reside in the territory of the EU. It's not a right to any particular quality of life or to any particular standard of living. So it's a fine balance, in my opinion, though, a very fine balance, because what's the point of residing somewhere if to do so you are caused pain? You could take it to some glib extreme examples, couldn't you? But I think the point is there. So to that extent, the appeal was refused. But it certainly wasn't ruled out that EU law might go this way in the future. And I'm certain that this is not the end of the case.
Well, I was about to say, maybe that this is a case that might push it in the direction of going a little further.
Well, indeed. And I think it's interesting that as was argued by Mr. Drabble and Mr. Karnick, it's not the case that this has not been considered. That the wording of Zambrano itself and some further authorities, there's a case called Derecci, which deals with a charter on fundamental freedoms, which includes passages that seem to be a little unclear as to why they're there, and they seem to indicate that potentially there is scope for movement in this direction, but not this court, apparently. This court said, no, we're not ready for that yet.
It might be interesting to see where politics takes this as well, of course, with if there is a new negotiated deal between Britain and the EU. It might be interesting to see where politically that leads.
Well, but to be honest, I don't think that's going to improve our position too much, considering that these cases tend to revolve around deportations.
The effects of what happens if we pull out of the EU is going to be an interesting show all in itself, I'm sure.
I think that's a whole series, isn't it? One thing, actually, I'd be quite interested in doing is, at some point, and I don't know if any listeners have already done this, I know we've got some academics with an awful lot of time on their hands, it seems. Well, it's about time we had perhaps an audit into the Human Rights Act and the ECHR in relation to criminal proceedings. There have been such audits in relation to family and clearly in terms of immigration. I'm not aware at the moment of any concise audit as to situations where the government has found to have overreached its powers or acted in some way that is unfairly punitive. There are plenty of cases of it, but I'm not sure if anyone's pulled them together, because it may be the population at some point might need an explanation in concise terms as to why the Human Rights Act is an important piece of legislation and why it perhaps ought to stay where it is.
I still think that it's one of the most commonly misunderstood pieces of legislation.
Of course it is.
There is horribly, I think, still a very negative public connotation with the Human Rights Act, effectively. We discussed it last week. You've got Malta laying off human rights against gay rights. I mean, where does that leave us when a state does it? So I
absolutely.
Totally,
and the same person who called the Human Rights Act the terrorist charter was forced to agree last week that it was a very good piece of legislation insofar as it allowed a Christian Caucasian woman to wear her cross at work. I mean,
impartial if I've ever heard
there, but absolutely, yeah. Anywho.
Right. Well, I think that's us done for this week.
Absolutely. So
thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you very much, Ben. Not entirely sure what we're covering next week, but I think we can probably say goodbye from our country retreat, our city pad, and our townhouse.
Absolutely. And if you want to contact us, you know where to find us. If you're having any problems with subscribing to the show or finding us in our new location, but have seen us pop up on Twitter or whatever else, send us a tweet. Of course, you won't hear this, but if you know, pass it on. Send it on to a friend.
Oh, we'll tweet something so that you know where to find us.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Bye.